Good morning, everyone. It is truly an honor to have the opportunity to do this with you, and thank you so much. As you can imagine, everyone here has some connection to AFRMC in Israel, me included, as Josh said, I was born there. But you had a personal relationship with our namesake, Yitzhak Rabin. And in fact, you were with the Rabin family just after he was assassinated. Can you give us some insights as to what he was like as a person and a friend, and what the impact of his death has been on Israel?
Thank you, Midian. Thank you for coming this morning, and thank you to the American Friends for the Rabin Medical Center for hosting this event. When I was asked to do this, I immediately agreed to, as I'd done an earlier event. And that's not just because of my association with Yitzhak Rabin, but because I know well the Rabin Medical Center from my time in Israel. I remember the treatment that they gave to Leah Rabin. She, I believe, died in Rabin Medical Center. But she was being treated there. I remember visiting her there. And I believe that when I was there, that's when she hatched the idea that the head of what was it called before?
Balancing,
right. Head of Balancing, to call up the Rabin Medical Center. Yitzhak Rabin was, of course, a great Israeli warrior, war hero of the Six-Day War, and then a visionary statesman and peacemaker for Israel. But it was that combination of security experience and credentials with a political experience that didn't go so well when he first became prime minister. But he learned a lot from that experience, so that the second time around, when he was elected again, 1992, he was, I think, in a much better position to fulfill his what he regarded as his life's mission, having fought in Israel's wars, now being determined to bring Israel to peace. And as he said, in those days, in his second time as prime minister, you make peace with your enemies, not with your friends. And it was a very courageous Yitzhak Rabin who had to take on a lot of intense opposition in Israel, particularly when he decided to make peace with Yasser Arafat and shake hands with Yasser Arafat and try to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And as we know, that led to his assassination, not by an Arab, unfortunately, but by a Jew. And so the whole story is one of incredible courage and incredible tragedy. And tragedy not just for Yitzhak Rabin and his family, but tragedy for Israel. I was there as ambassador, as you said, Mitty, when he was assassinated. I had been sent out by President Clinton, whom I had worked for the first 2 years of the Clinton administration as his Middle East advisor in the National Security Council, in the White House. I was responsible for that choreography of the handshake on the White House lawn when Rabin shook hands with Arafat and Peres and Abu Mazen signed the Oslo Accords. But Clinton sent me out to Israel after we'd done the Israel-Jordan peace treaty to negotiate the Israel-Syria peace deal. It's not known really the story of those days, but essentially in those days, the Israeli-Palestinian process was on track. We'd just gotten the Israel-Jordan peace treaty. And Rabin had told Clinton that if his requirements were met when it came to security and full normalization, peaceful relations with Syria, he would be prepared to withdraw from the Golan Heights, full withdrawal from the Golan Heights. This is not well known that he made that commitment to President Clinton. It's also not well known, although it's there in the official record, that four other prime ministers after Rabin made similar commitments to American presidents to in exchange for peace with Syria, to have full withdrawal from the Golan, including Shimon Peres and Ehud Barak, but also Bibi Netanyahu and Ehud Olmert. The only one of the five prime ministers that I dealt with in my two terms as ambassador in Israel that wouldn't do it was Arik Sharon, who was an infantry man who valued the high ground. But all the other prime ministers considered peace with Syria in those days as worth giving up the Golan Heights. So it's worth just, this is all a footnote, but because we're fed with the idea that Israel could never come down from the Golan Heights, five Israeli prime ministers were prepared to make that exchange of territory for peace. But to come back to Rabin, he had told Clinton he was prepared to do it. He told Clinton, it's in your pocket, not to be taken out until you get my needs satisfied when it came to security arrangements and full normalization of relations. And Clinton sent me out as ambassador to work with Rabin on the Syrian peace deal. And we thought that we were going to get it, that it was going to come in the next 6 months. And instead, of course, 5 months after I arrived, Rabin was assassinated. And not only did that idea go out the window, but the whole peace process with the Palestinians then cratered and led eventually to the Second Intifada, the destruction of all trust, incredible loss of life on both sides, thousands killed over 5 years, and the whole edifice of peacemaking that we had built with Rabin was destroyed in the process. And since then, it's been impossible to resurrect it. And people often ask me the counterfactual, would it have been different if Rabin had survived? And of course, we can't know. But I do think that he not only understood how to deal with Arafat, but had built a relationship of trust with Arafat, and together with Peres were able to move him to a position where he would be prepared to meet Israel's requirements. And he was the only Palestinian leader who could deliver his people to that. It's a whole long story as to what actually happened in the end. But Rabin's assassination really, I think, put paid to the prospect of Israeli-Palestinian peace, at least in my lifetime. And we see how Israelis and Palestinians now are kind of condemned to this horrendous cycle of violence. And just in the recent days, we see it erupting again.
So here we are, we're 30 years after his death. And Israel is facing a complex situation with the democracy protests and the differing opinions on how best to address the issues raised by the demonstrators. Can you shed light on the judicial reforms being proposed by Netanyahu, sparking these protests? And what do you see as viable solutions?
So it's difficult for us to follow from afar the details of this judicial reform proposal that Netanyahu's government is trying to push through the Knesset. But the reason that it has generated such widespread opposition in Israel, the likes of which we haven't seen for, I guess, something like 15 years now, and certainly we haven't seen anything like this since I guess the peace movement in the days of Yitzhak Rabin, what's motivating the people to come out into the streets, and this is not just leftists, this is centrists and this is people from the right, is the sense that Israel's democracy is being threatened because the reforms would take away the independence of the judiciary. That's the heart of the matter. There is a subtext that as part of this, there is an effort to change the selection of justices. And that has taken on the appearance or the narrative that Netanyahu is trying to stack the court so as to protect himself from the judicial process of the trials that he's going through on corruption charges and breach of trust. I actually don't think that's true, but it doesn't matter what I think. I don't think he needs to stack the court to deal with his judicial problems with the courts. But he has lost control of this narrative, which for Netanyahu is pretty unusual. He's the king of spin in Israel, but he's lost control of the narrative. So the judicial reform is also seen not only as a threat to the independence of the judiciary and therefore Israel's democratic institutions, but also as an attempt by Netanyahu to stack the court and get out of this charges that he's facing. And that combination has led to this widespread revolt. And it's really something to behold. I compare it here. It's not a fair comparison. But we did not have, you know, over 150,000 Americans coming out in the streets to defend our democracy when it was under assault. And yet in Israel, this commitment to Israel's democracy is very real, tangible, visceral amongst so many Israelis that they come out every Saturday night. They're out there in their tens of thousands. And I think it's a very, even though it's very troubling to see Israel go through this deep division, it's very heartening for we who care about Israel to see that there is such commitment to Israel, not just as a Jewish state, but as a Jewish and democratic state.
This past Sunday, there was an article in the New York Times regarding the potential for a normalization of diplomatic relations between the Saudis and Israel. Secretary of State Blinken was said to have given both Prime Minister Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman briefings about significant demands on both sides. This in an effort to push forward the Biden administration's long shot bid to broker a landmark diplomatic deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel. I was so happy to see that you were quoted as saying that President Biden has decided to go for it, and everyone in the administration now understands that the president wants this. You also said that a committed American president has long been essential for diplomatic breakthroughs between Israel and Arab nations. And when you're talking about a Middle East peace, it takes three to tango. Can you expand on what that actually means?
This is a very interesting development, and I don't know how many of you saw that article or have followed it, but it's what Joe Biden would call a BFD. Remember, that's what he told Obama the healthcare bill was. And when I said it takes three to tango, a committed American president on his own is insufficient to make peace in the Middle East. We've seen that over and over again. But a president who's committed to work with an Israeli leader and an Arab leader who are committed to making peace is a completely different story. That's what I mean by it takes three to tango. On their own, it's very hard for an Israeli and an Arab leader to make peace because it's so risky. They need the United States. They need an underwriter. You all can understand underwriting. And they need an American underwriter to be able to do it. So Begin and Sadat with Carter as the underwriter. King Hussein of Jordan and Yitzhak Rabin with Clinton as the underwriter, and you got peace treaties. So now we have a situation where Prime Minister Netanyahu, coming off the Abraham Accords, believes that peace with Saudi Arabia would be the most important achievement of his. It would be his legacy issue, and has been building towards this. It's no secret that he's engaged with Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. He's had a secret meeting with him. There's been a lot of interchange and even some steps towards normalization. So he wants it badly. But the important thing is that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has told the United States that he is ready to do it. And he's ready to do it with Joe Biden this year. And the only challenge, therefore, since we have three leaders who seem to be committed to doing it and have a sense of urgency about it, is that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, no fool he, has certain requirements. And they are not requirements of Israel. They are requirements of the United States. This is, for him, his relationship with Israel is fine. He gets what he wants in terms of strategic cooperation, security assistance. But his problem is that he's sitting on all this oil and all this wealth. He has grand visions for his country, but he can't defend himself. He can't defend his kingdom in a very dangerous neighborhood. He doesn't have that capability. He can't even take on Yemen in this war that he foolishly got himself involved in. And so he needs, and as part of this peace deal with Israel, he is insisting on a security guarantee from the United States. His ask is actually for a NATO-like Article 5 treaty commitment. Well, good luck with that, getting the two-thirds of the Senate to vote for Saudi Arabia on anything would be a stretch, but on a commitment that the United States would go to war if Saudi Arabia is attacked is a stretch. But that's his first requirement. His second requirement is opening the arms spigot so that he can buy essentially whatever he wants, up to and including F-35s, which are being denied him at the moment, because not only because of concerns in the Senate about his human rights record, but also because of Israel's qualitative military edge and our commitment to Israel on that front. So that's the second thing he wants, is essentially for the administration to get the Congress to unblock the arms supply channel and to increase the level of commitment there. And finally, just in case you thought those two were difficult, he wants United States acquiescence in and involvement in the establishment of an independent uranium enrichment capability in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has about 7% of the world's uranium reserves, and in the Crown Prince's efforts to replace oil over time, because of the understanding that it's a resource that the world is going to wean itself off, he wants to be a provider of enriched fuel for nuclear reactors. The fact that it could also be used for nuclear weapons is not lost on anybody, including him. So those are his asks. Now, to sweeten this demand, in terms of getting Netanyahu to lobby in Washington on Saudi Arabia's behalf, he has told Netanyahu, I don't care about the Palestinians. I don't need anything on the Palestinians. And he's told the White House the same thing. So here we have a typical Saudi game in which the foreign minister is out there almost every other day, as you may have noticed, saying there has to be, yes, full normalization, but there has to be a significant pathway towards a Palestinian state. On the one hand, public, and in private, MBS is saying, I don't care about them. What I need is these American commitments. So these three leaders are determined to try to figure out this complicated game. And the one last point I would make on this, which is a complicated one, is that Biden, I mean, the Crown Prince may not care about the Palestinians, and certainly Bibi, with his far-right government, doesn't want to pay for anything on the Palestinian front because it would more likely bring down his government as a result. And he wants to show he got peace for peace and didn't have to give anything on the Palestinians. But Biden actually needs something on the Palestinians for two important reasons. One, there's no way he's going to be able to bring the Democrats along unless he can also show that it's good for the Palestinians. And he cannot depend on MBS that after he's got through satisfying, if he can satisfy the three demands from the United States, that MBS won't say, but wait a minute, my daddy needs something on the Palestinians, king. Or you know, situation is so terrible in the West Bank, you know, I can't move forward unless there's something on the Palestinians. Mm. So for both reasons, Tony Blinken has already told AIPAC in a public address that there's going to have to be linkage in this deal with Palestinians. And if you think this through, how are you going to put together this kind of Rubik's Cube of all of these requirements is going to be very complicated. But if they can move it forward, Netanyahu is going to be faced with a choice, much like he was faced with a choice, as you may know, in the case of the UAE and the breakthrough for the Abraham Accords, when the Emiratis said, you can have annexation of the West Bank or normalization with the UAE, but you can't have both. You remember the UAE ambassador put this in an op-ed piece in the Israeli newspaper in Yedioth. And so Netanyahu had to block the annexation that was going on, the movement to annex that was going on at that time, and promise the Emiratis that there would be no annexation for, I think, 3.5 years. Now he's going to be placed in a similar situation, one way or the other, notwithstanding what MBS says. And he's going to, I think, end up, we'll see, in a situation where he will have to choose between his far-right government and its policies of de facto annexation of West Bank, which is going ahead at the moment, and peace with Saudi Arabia. That could bring down his government, but it could also provide a basis for a new government to be formed with the center parties justifying their joining with Netanyahu on the basis of peace with Saudi Arabia making this work.
So can we stay on the West Bank? The day after that article came out on Monday, Israeli military forces raided a refugee camp in the northern West Bank, igniting the fiercest day of fighting in years. And since then, the conflict has only escalated. Clearly, the status of a two-state solution is not a real prospect at this point while this kind of bloodshed is taking place. And settlements in the West Bank are expanding, and there is talk now that they will be legalized. Is there any hope that these negotiations between Israel and the Saudis, and I'm sorry, between Israel and the Palestinian Authority might resume? And would the possibility of Saudi-Israeli normalization impact these discussions?
Well, I'm sorry I preempted your question on the Israeli-Saudi side of it, but if we focus on the West Bank, it's really a grievous situation. I assume some of you, if not all of you, have watched the third season of Fauda, that Israeli production about the interaction between Israelis and Palestinians, and particularly the Shin Bet and Palestinian terrorists. And it's a case of life imitating art, because the incident that you refer to on Monday was the last scene of the third season of Fowler. It was exactly what happened.
Yeah.
They went in to pick up some terrorists into a refugee camp. The Israeli army forces there were ambushed, and they had to bring in helicopters to get them out. It's literally the scene that you see in the, if you haven't, you should watch it. It's well worth it. But the result was that I think 9 Palestinians were killed, 7 Israelis were wounded, but 91 Palestinians were wounded. And immediately there was a retaliation, a Hamas-sponsored retaliation. And what's important to understand about what's happening here is that you have a combination of the breakdown of the Palestinian authorities writ in these northern cities of Nablus and Jenin. The Palestinian security forces don't operate there anymore. They essentially don't have much control over the rest of the West Bank either, just Ramallah. So the Israeli army is going in to try to control things there, or prevent them from getting completely out of control, since it's a lawless area. And when it does so, it inevitably creates a response. And Palestinians, terrorists who are involved, they're trying to pick up, get killed, and that then generates a response. And the response is, more often than not, attacks on Israeli settlers, because there are now 560,000 settlers in the West Bank. And on every day, they are traveling on roads in the West Bank. Some of them are Israel-only roads, but most of them are not. And so they're easy targets. And there's easy access to weapons that are being smuggled in from Jordan, believe it or not, and Israel. And so, as a result, you see settlers being targeted, 4 killed in a roadside cafe on Tuesday. And then the settlers, settler youth, vigilantes, go in and as they did, I guess it was the night before last, I'm losing track of the days and nights, but they went in and burnt an Arab village, cars and destroyed shop fronts. And it's a kind of lawlessness and a situation that feels like it's out of control. And people have been predicting for a long time that a third intifada is coming. But I actually think that this is it. It's different to the second intifada, which involved large-scale demonstrations and Palestinian police using their arms to shoot at the Israeli soldiers from within the demonstrations, and Israeli soldiers firing back, and that kind of created the dynamic. Here we've got the dynamic that I was describing, which is a little bit different, but nevertheless, it's just a kind of constant. We get periods of calm for maybe a week or two, but then, boom! There's an incident, takes off again. And the Israeli army is now talking about a large-scale military operation to go into Jenin and Nablus. They're under pressure from the far-right members of the government to do that. If that happens, all hell could break loose, and Israel will be back in the Security Council being condemned and International Court of Justice, and, the whole scenario that we've witnessed before. There's no way in that context that we have that kind of eruption that it's going to be possible to move ahead on the Israeli-Saudi deal. It's just, the Saudis are not going to be able to play the game. Israel's going to be completely attention diverted, as will the United States as we try to intervene and calm things down. So there's a lot at stake, not least of which is lives of Israelis in this situation. And I'm not optimistic that we can go from there to a calming of the situation and then using the Israeli-Saudi peace deal to try to generate some progress towards a resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's very hard to see how we get there from here. But, you know, it's the Middle East, so you can never predict exactly how this will play out. Certainly the Israeli-Saudi potential for a peace deal can provide an incentive, but when killing is going on, it swamps everything, right to say.
So now we shift to Iran.
An easy one. Yeah.
Iran appears to be weeks away from enriching enough uranium to build 4 nuclear bombs. Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, is signaling a willingness to make a new nuclear deal with the West, but only on terms that would allow the Islamic Republic to maintain its nuclear threat. What is Israel's position on this? And will Israel feel compelled to act if a nuclear deal is not achieved?
So, first of all, you may have seen the reports in the last few weeks of this idea of a informal understanding between the United States and Iran that would have the following elements, more or less. I don't know exactly what it looks like, but in exchange for the Iranians committing to freeze their enrichment at the current situation and allowing inspections and committing not to attack American soldiers in the region and not to provide ballistic missiles or any kind of missiles to Russia for its war in Ukraine, the United States would give the green light to various banks around the world, I think mostly in South Korea, which is holding $5 billion of Iranian assets. I don't know exactly what the numbers would be. Some reports say $10 billion, some reports say $20 billion of Iranian assets that have been frozen would be released. And as well as that, the Americans that are being held in Iran, being held hostage essentially in Iran, would also be released. So this kind of package deal seems to be emerging. Whether it will come off or not is hard to tell, but I think there's something in it for both sides that makes sense. It's not a new agreement. It's not a return to the old nuclear agreement, JCPOA. And it does leave the Iranians with a stockpile of 60% enriched uranium. A stockpile that's probably large enough, if it were enriched to 90% uranium, would be enough for 4 bombs. Now, they'd have to convert that. They'd have to enrich it to 90% and convert it into a bomb, turn it into a bomb, and put that bomb on a delivery system before they actually had it, a nuclear weapon. But the fact that they are on the threshold at 60%, and it would only take them a few weeks at most to go to 90% weapons grade material, puts them on the threshold of being a nuclear power. And that is a highly problematic situation. This deal would freeze it, stop them enriching more, but it wouldn't remove that stockpile, and would in some ways acknowledge or accept that they could enrich 60%. So it's problematic, but it's a short-term fix to a very problematic situation. Now you asked, what is Israel's position on this? Well, Netanyahu has been surprisingly silent, has informed his cabinet, he's quoted as informing his cabinet, but has not expressed opposition to it. People have various theories about this. One is that the president has basically told him that he's not welcome to come and visit Washington until he stops the judicial reform process or gets a consensus. And there's no possibility of a consensus. The talks have just broken down. And so he's essentially unable to come to Washington. If he's unable to come to Washington, he can't lobby for the Saudi deal. He can't lobby against the Iran deal. He's kind of stuck. So one theory of the case is he's trying to behave himself at the moment on the Iran deal so that he can get to Washington and express his opposition there or at least get to work on the Saudi deal. But it's not an ideal situation for Israel. Of course, you could say that he brought it on himself by urging Trump to break the JCPOA, which had removed all of the enriched uranium from Iran and blocked Iranian enrichment. We wouldn't have been in this situation if the JCPOA had not been broken by Trump on Netanyahu's urging. I think also he may have learned from that experience that it's not a good idea to confront the President of the United States on these things, especially when he wants the President of the United States to help him with the Saudi deal. But this could well, if you follow the logic of all of this, this deal could well happen. While it's by no means ideal, it at least freezes the program. And I think good news for Israel in one sense. Israel, by all accounts, from the national security establishment, isn't yet ready to take military action against Iran's nuclear program. It still requires some time to build the capability, and it still requires some things from the United States. Buying time is not a bad thing in the short term for Israel, especially because, and this is a development that I think is very important, but has been hardly noticed, which is in the broader strategic relationship between the United States and Israel, something important is changing. The United States clearly has higher priorities in dealing with China's assertiveness and its growing military power in Asia and Russia's aggression in Europe. And three administrations, starting with Obama, but Trump as well, and Biden, have been trying to shift away from the Middle East, away from wars in the Middle East, to deal with these other priorities. We keep on kind of getting dragged back into the Middle East, but we cannot deal with those other priorities and deal with the Middle East at the same time. We have to find a way in the Middle East to do more with less. How can we do that? By relying on our allies and partners in the region to pick up the slack. And there's only one really capable ally in the region, and that's Israel. And so we are shifting in our strategic relationship with Israel, in which Israel is taking on greater responsibilities. It's now part of Central Command. It's exercising with the United States on an Iranian contingency more and more openly. And in a recent speech, which Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, made to the Washington Institute, he said one sentence which was pregnant with meaning. He said, "We recognize Israel's right to take independent action." And that, I think, was a public signal. I don't think I know it was a public signal that the United States has shifted from in the Obama administration being opposed to Israel acting on its own against the Iranian nuclear program to a situation that if it becomes necessary, that the United States would not oppose an Israeli military action. And this is important in the context of trying to deter Iran from moving from its 60% and crossing the threshold to having highly enriched uranium that can be used for weapons. Because that deterrent depends at the moment more on the United States than on Israel. But the Iranians know that the United States is not about to go to war with them because we've got other priorities. They can figure that out. They're not stupid. Therefore, our deterrence requires an enhanced Israeli deterrent because they do believe that Israel will act. And if they come to understand that we won't stop them, that enhances the deterrent. Even though the situation looks grim, it's actually, I mean, there are elements of it that I think are working in Israel's favor in terms of strengthening its deterrent and hopefully its ability to prevent Iran from crossing the nuclear threshold.
I could stay here all day, but Harrison will kill us because he needs his conference room back. So I have many more questions, but I think it's time to open it up to the audience. Thank you so much.
I'll ask a quick question. Early May, we heard this rumor of this Chinese brokered agreement between the Saudis and the Iranians, which I think caught some of us off guard, but we haven't heard much since. I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on how that influences the various discussions we're having and context that
needs to be. Technically, it caught the Biden administration off guard. And one of the reasons that the president has decided to go for the Israeli-Saudi deal is because the Chinese brokered the Iranian Saudi deal. What is the, what is this deal all about? It's essentially an arrangement of convenience for both Iran and Saudi Arabia. One should not imagine that the intense centuries-old rivalry between Shias and Sunnis is represented by Iran and Saudi Arabia as the leaders of these two religious camps in the Muslim world have been resolved or will ever be resolved. That tension and division is there. But for the Iranians who are feeling the pressure domestically from internal dissent, who are feeling the economic pressure from sanctions, even though they've been relieved somewhat, see an advantage in trying to calm things down, which is precisely what Saudi Arabia wants, and by the way, which is precisely what the United States wants in the Gulf. And so there's this confluence of interests. The Iranians appear to be giving up a low card. That is to say, they're telling the Houthis in Yemen to stop attacking Saudi Arabia. And that is the minimum requirement that the Saudis are asking for, so that the truce can continue in Yemen and they can try to get out of there. So that's the kind of short-term benefit for the two sides in doing this deal. I don't think either of them imagine that it's anything more than that, but it can develop. It's a detente. And it's a detente which essentially, we're talking about freezing the nuclear program, freezes Iran's situation in the region, which is one of great influence in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, that are much more important to Iran than Yemen. So they can give up on Yemen, at least for the time being, because the Saudis are going to back off countering them in the other parts of the Arab world, which really matter to them. So I think that it will hold for a while. I don't think it indicates that China is suddenly going to be coming in and replacing the United States in the region. First of all, China, if you follow Henry Kissinger's assessment of this, and I think he knows more than most, and certainly more than me, China doesn't have the desire to dominate other regions of the world beyond Asia. It seeks economic relations, it seeks political standing in the Middle East, it seeks, most importantly of all, to protect the lines of communication that between the Gulf and China, which provide Iran with 60% of its imported oil, comes from the Gulf. And in that regard, if you think about it, their interests in the Gulf are pretty much the same as ours. We want the free flow of oil at reasonable prices from the Gulf as well. But the difference is, we're the ones who have the military capability there. We're the ones who actually have our boot on China's throat, if you think about it in that regard. They are dependent on us to police the waterways. And so if they have an interest in stability, as shown by this agreement and calming things down in Yemen, that's in our interest. And you may actually see emerging from this cooperation between China and the United States, although it will be at a kind of lower level because the whole relationship seems to be so screwed up at the moment. But nevertheless, that just like they talk about climate change as being an area of cooperation, I think you're going to see them cooperating in the Gulf, which is kind of counterintuitive, but I think the reality is that both powers want stability there.
So I want to just thank the ambassador. Thank you, Mitty. Thank you again to SL Green. And thank you for being here. Next event we'll do will be sometime in the fall, perhaps with the Israeli ambassador of the United Nations. So thank you all for being here.
Mitty, you did a good job.
Thank you.
Yeah, you did. Great question.